set for. We're finishing it today, so you can give them to me. Well, after at the end of the class, okay. But from previous problems, that's 2 or 3, 1, I think. Okay, perfect. Problem number 3: accretion disk, Padmanabhan 313. Okay. So, who's gonna solve it for us?
I can do 3 anyway. 3, I don't really understand 3 numbers.
And 3B is actually, it's simple. You could get it easily from 3A. So, thank you very much. So I guess you have complimentary coffee. Yesterday, I think. Is that on?
It is now. So we're looking at accretion disks, and 3A asks us to consider a viscous accretion disk with an inner radius r min, outer radius r max, and then we're supposed to assume that there's some sort of viscous stress that transports angular momentum, as well as that the gas flows in Keplerian orbits. Keplerian orbits. And then, using these assumptions, we're supposed to show that dE, the value of dE, absolute value of dE, is given by this. So we have this situation where we have some central object, and then we have the accretion disk around this, and it's slowly spiraling inwards. So we have a radius r and then a dr. And this is the rate of change between r, dr, and r. So we know that the change in mass, we can start with the change in mass for this angular ring. And this is given by dm dt d volume dt d, or rho, sorry. But we know the volume for angular disk or angular ring is given by this. Between R, dr, and r.
So what is L?
So L will be the thickness. Okay. L is thickness. This is equal to 2r or 2 pi r dr L plus order dr, which we neglect. So then we put this in here and we get. This is equal to negative. So we're choosing a negative explicitly because we're assuming that the mass is going down, so that the disk is, the ring is losing that. So we have that.
So this is the inner part. One side of the ring, right? Or both sides of the ring.
This is both sides, isn't it? So we're assuming that the change in mass is negative. We're assuming that mass is falling inwards, mm-hmm. so that this ring is losing mass. So we're just going to explicitly.
But do you see if, say, this ring is fixed in a space, or is it falling? Because if, since it's changing in mass, it means it's not falling in.
Okay, so yeah, so I guess it's at a fixed area, and then we're looking at the mass that's flowing through that area.
So there will be some mass
going out that way.
Going in and going out, what's going out, right? So I think this is only one of, right? Yeah, this is just the mass so, going in or going out.
So yeah. They have positive and negative solutions.
Yeah.
So, okay, we're taking.
These should cancel each other because in a steady state, the mass within a ring doesn't change. Right? Everything through it. So the mass that goes into a ring should be the same as the mass that goes out. So I guess that's the same value. So that's constant basically throughout. Should you say it's constant throughout the disk or? I think so.
Well, it's just going to depend on radius and VR, right?
So that's basically the like a current conservation for equation. So density times velocity times area. The density times velocity is current density, and at that times area, that becomes current. That should be constant throughout, because it's fastidious. If nothing is changing with time, does that make sense? Good.
Yep. So since it is steady state, we apply the Navier-Stokes equation for steady state in cylindrical coordinates because those are natural coordinates for this problem. So from that, we get for the pi component of this equation that rho and then the radial component will be given by this. Now, we were asked to assume that the gas flows in Keplerian orbits. So we know that V lambda, or sorry, V phi, will be given by this. We're also asked to assume that it's spiraling slowly inward. So we can assume that EVR, ER, is equal to 0. This gives the following equation from the radial component. And we see that d rho dr is equal to 0. Just saying that rho is constant, radially constant.
Right, that you mean that's P, right? No, actually, sorry.
It's pressure? I thought it was rho.
There is a pressure and there is, yeah, so that equation should be pressure.
Oh, sorry, yeah, I can't read my own writing. It's just P. Yeah. Sorry. Yeah, so the pressure is radially constant. And then we'll analyze the phi component as well. And we notice that E V phi D T is equal to E G said E phi equal to zero. They're not exactly equal to zero, but we're assuming that E V phi E phi is much, much greater than these.
What is that, R phi or?
This is V. And from Keplerian orbit, we have E D R V phi is equal to negative this. And then we just plug it in to here. And we get this. Simplifying. And then we can put this back into our equation for the infalling matter. Because the R in the row. Okay. Now, in Padmanabhan, he pulled out equation of flux. I didn't really know flux of energy.
Okay.
I wasn't really sure where he got that from, but I used it.
So could you write down what it is?
So he has S of R approximately equal to
sigma R I.
I'm not sure.
So that must be the viscous part of the stress. Has something to do with viscosity. Okay. So that must be derived somewhere in one of the previous problems. So it's funny. I don't think actually none of these are really necessary. But yeah, sigma is usually the derivative of velocity. Okay, so go on. So let's see what we get.
And then we can say that given this equation, that the change in energy is given by this. So.
Okay, so S of R is the energy flux through some surface, right?
Through this surface, dr plus dr surface.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So then, yeah, the energy flux in between, or the change in energy between.
The change in energy flux means how much energy is dissipated in some angles. Okay.
And then we have, just substituting our form for this, we have an equation which relates L and sigma. Yeah. Exactly. And then we're gonna say that, as I said before, actually, that the phi component of the velocity is much, much greater than the other components. We're assuming, spiraling, right? And we assume no z velocity, not or negligible z velocity, and negligible radial velocity. Then we can say that v squared is approximately equal to v phi squared. Then we have that 1/2 v squared plus psi is equal to, again, using the Keplerian orbit, and then we plug that in here. We will plug that in there. We also have to approximate what this is. So V I is equal to V R R plus V.
Yeah, so you assume the form for sigma. So sigma is sigma ij is partial vi by partial of xj plus partial vj by partial. It's just a derivative of the gradient of the velocity.
Getting low right now. So now we use these, we put it in here, and we get a form for the change in energy. And it'll be the form that we're looking for.
And there's another board.
I can put it here. to... And then, again, making use of the Keplerian orbit, we say that and substituting our form, yeah, that's right, we just use the Keplerian orbit, which is what we're required to show.
So what happened to the second term up there?
This term, we substituted. We substituted this, and then we simplified because they're.
What did you
they just differ by coefficient. So we have. I'm substituting. Our three. This is equal to.
So the relationship between VR and I think that's just in the board that you covered, right? The relation between V sub R and eta, right?
Yeah.
And then that V sub R is related to M dot, basically.
Well, we just put this in, basically. We know this is equal to M dot, right?
Yes, good. Ah, I see. So just replace L eta by M
and then dot. One of these.
So that's the energy dissipated. Is this the energy dissipation rate, do you think, or is this just energy itself?
Dissipation rate.
Right.
Yeah.
It has the dimension of energy per unit time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so now what do you think? Does everybody, does this make sense to you guys? Or? I guess you this is a Padmanabhan system, right? So it must be right.
Well, unless there's typos, right?
Unless there's typos. Yeah, that three halves kind of doesn't feel right to me. I don't know. Somehow I feel it must be. It should have a three halves there. So let me tell you where. So this is a detailed derivation, which is nice. But I had an intuition for this, which doesn't have a three halves. So.
Do you want the mic?
Sure. So let's use this one.
I can do this one.
So what do we have here? So we have
okay, BlackBerry doesn't go with Mike. It's Julian several times.
So we have a disk. Well, it's not very. It's a circular disk. And basically, there is a flow of gas, but it has some thickness. Mostly going an angular orbit or circular orbit, but since there is viscosity, you can lose energy and then fall into the
the central star. If there was no viscosity, as Nathan pointed out, then there wouldn't be any reason for these annuli of different radius to change their radii. They would just go around and around without anything. The fact that there is viscosity means that actually these different annuli can rub against each other, heat up the system, and in the process lose energy. And this is the quantitative relationship between VR. Well, this is the quantitative relationship between VR and viscosity. If there was no viscosity, then there wouldn't be any accretion. So that's reasonable. Now, how much do you lose energy per annulus? So let's think about it. If you take an annulus, which is, so this it's going around. If you look at all gas in this ring, or just it is almost a ring, a thick ring. It's rotating with Keplerian velocity, but it's also losing energy gradually. So if you move in as the gas spirals slowly in, your annulus or your ring is losing energy because its radius gets smaller, right? So the energy is, what is the total energy of this ring, or let's call it delta E? It's going to be, so what is the energy? It's going to be the mass times 1/2 of V phi squared minus dm over r, right? This is precise. So this is the potential for energy. This times delta m is potential energy. This is the kinetic energy. And m is the mass of the central object, right? So this is reasonable. Now, for Keplerian orbits, and that assuming that these are nearly circular, V phi is a function, is related to r, as Nathan wrote. V phi squared is dm over r. So this is just, and this is the real relationship, really. It's 1/2 of delta m dm over r. This is the energy of a ring, but the energy is changing with time as the ring is losing energy and moving a spiraling inward. And so there's a difference between this ring and the ring that Nathan considered. The ring that Nathan considered has an inflow and outflow of energy into it because, but mainly because it was fixed in the space. So there were matter falling into it and matter going out of it. Here I'm imagining a ring that's moving in or falling in with the flow. So for this ring, there is nothing coming in and out of it because it's falling in with the flow, but this energy is changing with time because its radius is changing with time. So delta E dot is going to be, so the derivative of this, which is 1/2 of dm delta m divided by r squared times r dot. And r dot is basically the rate at which the radius is changing, which is just v sub r dot that's been calculated. So this dm delta m v sub r divided by 2r squared. So this is the rate at which the energy of this guy is changing. The energy of every ring is changing. So let's see. Now, how do you think this is related to the energy dissipation within the ring? Is it related? Is it the same? Because this is not quite the same thing, right? If I can, let's see, where is the eraser? Oh, here's. I can substitute here from the definition of V sub R. Well, let's see, can I? Well, okay, so I can substitute here in terms of V sub R and delta M. So let's put it here. So V sub R, Nathan calculated in terms of M dot, say it's minus 2 pi R L rho V sub R. And delta M is just 2 pi R dr. It's the area of this ring times L becomes the volume times rho is the density. Okay? So delta, so that formula then I can substitute from these two. Delta E dot is going to be dm over 2r squared. V sub r is, there is a minus sign, right? Did I have the minus sign? I think I have the minus sign, right? There's a minus sign m dot divided by 2 pi r l rho, and then it's times delta m, which is 2 pi r l rho dr. Or, well, this is delta r or dr, it doesn't matter what we call it. Delta r. So these cancel. And this is almost the same thing that Nathan had without a tree. So let's see if you understand that. This is minus gm over 2r squared times m dot times delta r. And so I can take one of these r's here. Gm over r is just b phi squared. So this is more almost the same thing, which was written somewhere up here, without the factor of 3. Okay. So what are we missing? What's the difference here? So this is the energy that a co-moving ring is losing with time. And at least that's what we calculated here. And you see, we didn't really have to assume much about how viscosity work here. We just had to assume that there is a viscosity that causes some info. And the fact that the key assumption there is that you have almost circular, almost Keplerian orbit. So then the nature of viscosity doesn't matter too much if it doesn't change almost Keplerian orbit very much. So now what's the difference between these two? So this is the energy loss per in co-moving coordinates, if we say, or in Lagrangian coordinates, which are following the W. This is energy loss in Eulerian coordinates, which is which are not fixed in object. They are not fixed in the flow, they are fixed in real space. So does anybody have an idea why there is a factor of 3 difference? What causes the factor of 3? Because that's not very clear to me, to be frank. Okay, let's throw out ideas. What do you think? Yeah.
So maybe there's flow from other rings that are also moving, but in the static case, still.
Mm-hmm. I see. Okay. Okay, good. Maybe. So. Well, let's see if we can estimate this. So if this is the actual dissipation rate per unit mass, well, you can define it per unit mass. So here you can say that every unit mass that's falling in loses this much energy per time, gm over 2rs squared times v sub r. Right? Now, so this is per unit mass. Maybe we can translate that to per unit fixed radii. I wonder.
Oops.
So maybe that makes a difference. Somehow I'm a bit skeptical actually about that factor of three. And I know there are typos in the book, but so I'm hesitant between trying to justify the factor of three and saying that maybe it shouldn't be there.
Well, I followed another way to derive this. I reached the factor of three.
So what was your way?
Writing equations of steady state equation bits.
Uh-huh.
Writing those equations.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So how did you? Okay. So let's discuss that. So. But are you writing the same viscosity equations? What were the questions? Are you writing these equations?
Yes.
Nathan? OK, so this is Nathan. So is this different? So it's the same derivation that Nathan had, all right? Or I see. Yours are?
Yes.
OK. And you also get the factor of three. OK. So let's delay judgment on this factor of three. Because somehow this seems to me, where was this? Somehow this seems to me all that there is to it. But then again, let's see. Okay, so let's do this another way. So let's imagine the whole disk, that let's say is truncated at some large radius, is falling in. Because of the viscosity. And so it does lose some energy, right? Because, let's put it another way. So we want to use conservation of total energy now instead of differential energy elements. So the whole disk gets smaller in time, right? You start with a bigger disk, you end up with a smaller disk because there is an inflow. Okay. And we decided there's a way to keep this down. I don't remember what it was.
A book.
Which book?
Gravity.
Gravity book? Okay. This is not a book. Okay, let's do the Padmanabhan book. Okay. So your disk becomes smaller, right? It falls deeper into the gravitational potential. It means that it loses energy, and that energy should go into radiation, for example, right? Because of energy conservation, that's the only thing, or into heat. It should go somewhere, right? So the energy of the disk, assuming that it was always Taylorian, it's going to be a sum of those individual rings. Each of them have energy minus 1/2 delta m times gm over r. Okay? But then when this becomes smaller, you will start from this the big disk and you end up with a smaller disk with a smaller radii. The energy changes because you can, in a steady state, if you assume a steady state inside, this inner part hasn't changed. It's the same velocity structure and same mass density structure. It's just that you've lost this outer annulus. Right? Is that the correct? No, that's not quite true. Okay, so let's say that there's an inner radius and an outer radius. Okay, let's say there's an inner radius and outer radius. This way, we are more comfortable about what we're doing. So the disk has an outer radius, which is shrinking, and an inner radius, which is also shrinking. So in some small, if you compare the two situations within some small time difference, this part shrinks a bit. So you lose this part, and you gain this part. And overall, you lose energy because this energy of this guy is more negative than the energy of this guy. So the change in energy is going to be minus 1/2 delta m. And the mass in these two should be the same because of mass conservation, right? So it's a gm divided by r in, plus 1/2 delta m gm r out. So this is the part that you're losing. This is the part that you're gaining. Okay. So this is a total energy, change of energy of the disk. And interesting. Now, here's an idea. Why not write this as 1/2 delta m integral gm over r squared dr? Is this correct? Okay, I should say it doesn't really give you anything much different. So if you want to write this down as a sum or an integral across a disk, it's again 1/2 delta m gm over r squared delta dr, which is this formula basically. Well, delta m divided by delta t is m dot. Okay, so.
Excuse me, can you explain why you the energy, the change of energy that way? Because
this.
We are speaking of the rate of energy transfer, not the energy itself.
Well, if this is a full moving ring, if it's falling in with the, if the ring is falling in with the gas, then this is how much the energy of this changes with time. Now, is there an energy transfer? So that's a good question. So supposedly this energy is transferred somewhere. It's not going to be because of energy conservation. But we know that this is how much the energy of this changes, right? Because if there is a change in radius of the ring, this is the energy, so that's how much the change. So this energy goes somewhere, I agree. It goes, as far as this ring is concerned, this energy is given to this other, well, this is the energy lost to heat basically due to friction against these two other annuli, the inner boundary and the outer boundary of the ring. Because there is some friction, this energy is lost to that. And that's it. Okay, so I'm,
I think that maybe we don't differ by a factor, but we could differ by a term. Because maybe I include
I see.
I'm adding a term.
Yeah, you're right. So there is this extra term here. There is indeed this extra term.
Because what happens here is that we are not assuming we have viscosity. We are just assuming that we have a Keplerian orbit which is changing radius.
Yeah.
And because of this change of radius, we have an energy transfer. In addition to it, we have viscosity energy loss.
Yeah.
Which is what the sigma term is.
But that the viscosity is the reason that you're losing energy. So if it, I understand what you're saying. Okay. So maybe I should think about this more, because somehow I thought that this argument usually gave the right answer. But so this factor of three a bit confused me. Might have something to do with the fact that for a fixed annulus there is something coming in and something coming out, and that might be making the difference as the fixed versus co-moving annulus. But okay, so let's delay on this for a bit. So there's next part of the problem. Who has done that? Because that just asks for a scaling argument, doesn't depend on the factor of two. Looking for volunteers. You can do it.
No, I wanted to do four, actually.
Okay, so who hasn't done? I think, AJ, you haven't done any problems. No. Do you want to do it?
No.
Okay. How about you, Horace? You couldn't do it. Okay. Okay. Me neither. Sure, you can raise this one.
Okay, so in this part of the question, we want to see what is the relationship between the intensity and the frequency. So we have the energy dissipated over there. Now we want to see what is energy dissipated per area, which is going to be just say over pi r squared, which is proportional to V phi squared over R squared. And we know what is V phi squared, so this is going to be proportional to R to the power of minus 3. And the energy dissipated per area is actually the flux, which we know flux is proportional to temperature to the power of 4. So from here, we can conclude that temperature is proportional to R to the power of minus 3 over 4. But the, from the Planck function, from the low frequency part of the Planck function, if we write the Planck, actually the...
Can you write the full form and then get the...
Yeah. So that's the Planck function. And for a small, very small nu, we can use the approximation that e to the power of h nu over kt is the same as h nu over kt plus 1. So if we use that in the Planck function, then we get
so this is the so-called Rayleigh-Jeans limit, right?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So we get something like that. So just write it here. So now we use the fact that we know that temperature related to r to the power of minus 3/2, 3/4. So there is an upper limit for the r, for the radius, as r max. Which, based on that, r max proportional to nu to the power of minus 4/3. So for the total intensity, if we integrate over the angulus that we have.
I'm sorry, but what is that? R max is?
It's the...
I think R max is nu to the minus 4/3.
Well, we know that temperature is proportional to R to the power of minus 3/4.
Okay.
And we know that the intensity is proportional to nu squared t. So
that just says I nu is nu squared times r to the minus 3.
Yeah.
But you, what you say, r max is proportional to r nu to the minus 4.
Actually, I wasn't sure about that. I just used Padmanabhan's definitions.
Let's figure that out.
So basically, I think the argument behind that is the peak of temperature or the peak of emission depends on temperature in that way. And that's in the Planck function, that's also the point where the Rayleigh-Jean limit is completely useless. And but it's also notable that after that point, the emission drops off with frequency
exponentially.
Yeah, it drops off exponentially really quickly.
Okay.
So you could make an approximation that R it goes, or that the emission is non-zero for R between zero and some R max using this function, which will be correct enough.
So that's S nu equal to K, okay, so that's S nu equals KT. That sets that. So that's the upper limit of the Rayleigh-Jean's. Okay, so let's do that. Let's try that. So let's see where, for every frequency, where is the radius at which S nu equals KT? Can you just write that down?
At which frequency h nu is equal to kt?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So we know how t depends on radius.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
So this tells you that, well, this is in a very new max. This is the maximum frequency in which you can trust the Rayleigh-Jean. And it depends on radius.
Now, the thing I don't understand, why would it give us a maximum radius? I think it would give us a minimum radius? No, you're right.
It's a maximum.
Because what happens is that at larger and larger radii, temperature gets lower, and for a fixed frequency, at some point you fall into the exponential tail of the Planck distribution, if temperature is very low.
Yeah.
And so then you don't see anything, essentially. So that gives you a maximum radius. At low radii, the temperature is high, so you're in the Rayleigh-Jeans limit, perfect for your frequency. Okay, so it's just that is just the inverse of this relationship. Okay, good.
I guess that's just the answer that you want us to do, and then R max is related to something like that.
Okay, so it's just integral of mu squared t R d r area. Okay, does this make sense to everybody? At low frequencies, we have this new to the 1/3 behavior. So can you say how far we can, what is the maximum frequency we can trust this? Or whether there is a maximum frequency?
Maximum frequency.
Yeah, because this is correct at low frequencies, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think so. Because you're using Rayleigh-Jeans limit, so. So how far? What is the maximum frequency? Any idea? So if your disk has a finite extent, if your disk doesn't have an inner or outer radius, then this is it. This is exactly the thing. But if your disk has an outer or inner radius, then that means your power laws are truncated. This is truncated, so there's a minimum somewhere that this temperature matches low area, and the same at large area. So which one of them would be more relevant? Which one of them would cut off this relationship? Is it going to be the larger, the outer radius of the disk or the inner radius?
The inner radius, probably.
The inner radius?
Yeah.
You think so? Why?
Because frequency becomes bigger and bigger in inner radius, so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the limit breaks down when t gets really small, as we were saying before.
Yes.
So that mean that there that would be bigger in radius. Yeah.
So it's hard to look. So I mean, one way to see it is just to write down everything explicitly, right? It's just without making an approximation. So this is I mu, and we want to integrate it over area. So what you have is integral of r d r. And that I knew, which is nu cubed divided by k
the function of R. So T of R. And this is from R mean with some R inner. Let's call it R inner for R outer. And T of R has a part of R. Okay. Now let's look at it. So let's call this, I don't know, A. And I can just use this, I can simplify this integral. I can just extract mu mu here. There is no R dependence. And I can define this as some integration variable. Let's call it lambda. So now lambda becomes.
If you want the microphone?
So there's mu cube. Sorry, I keep interrupting you guys. So lambda is h nu divided by k times tr, k a r to the minus 3/4. Okay. So this says that r to the minus 3/4, or let's say r to the 3/4, is just K A lambda divided by H nu. And nu is constant in the integral. You're not integrating over nu. So R is just this to the power of 4th there. And you can just substitute it here. So there is a lambda mean and lambda max, which are related to R mean and R max, using this relation, that relationship. And then this is RDR. So there is KA divided by H nu to the 8/3. And there is, so it's 4/3. Lambda to the 1/3, and there's another 4/3, so that's 5/3, I guess. Right. And did I make a mistake? So it's 1/3 plus 4/3. Yeah. Okay, good. So this is what we get. So it's nu cube nu to the power of 3 minus 8/3. So that's 9/3 minus 8/3, that's 1/3. That's what we wanted to get. And there are some constant factors we don't really care about. And then there is this integral of lambda to the 5/3 d lambda. This is 5. Then e to the lambda minus 1. Then the lambda mean and lambda max are set are proportional to R mean and R max. So lambda, this is some constant, let's call it, I don't know, kappa times R max to the 3/4. And this is kappa R mean to the 3/4. Okay. Good. So if there were, and we want to see where there's a frequency. We want actually to keep the frequency dependencies here. So the frequency, so lambda is proportional to frequency times some power of. So there is frequency dependence. So these limits are R max or R mean to the power of 3/4 times frequency times some constant. Okay? So now, given that we have a formula, what is the answer?
the is there a lower cutoff? And so actually, what is the regime in which you can trust this, that this is a scaling? This is becomes independent of mu. So this is an integral that kind of looks like this. So it's a power law, and then it exponentially tapers off. Somewhere around 1, it peaks. But then you cut it off here and here. This is the inner part, and this is the outer part where you cut off. So the integral is between these two limits. As long as these two limits are relevant, the lower limit is very small compared to 1, and the upper limit is very large compared to 1. Then you can trust this, right? So what trust is to be almost a constant, whatever is the integral, if this was 0 and this was infinity. So the constraint is that R max times 3/4, so to the power of 3/4 times nu must be much larger than 1, or sorry, much larger than kappa, whatever it is, some number. And R mean to the power of 3/4 times nu should be much less than kappa inverse. Okay. Now, can we say what sets the upper limit of what maximum frequency and minimum frequency now or not? Based on this, we could. So mathematically, this is all there is to it. So what's the answer? What's the maximum frequency that yeah. That makes sense, right? So this says that the frequency should be less than something over R mean. So it's indeed R mean, right, that matters for maximum frequency. There is also a minimum frequency that's set by this, right? So, and I guess in a sense it does make sense because so I guess this is what Mina mentioned, that small radii that are hotter, so they contribute to higher frequencies. Large radii, they're colder, so they contribute to lower frequencies. So if there's a breakdown of this scaling relation, at low frequencies it would be due to large radii, and at high frequencies would be due to the small radii. Okay, so good. So we got almost all we know about accretion disk, except for that factor of 3. But I guess if you want to end up working on accretion, unless you want to end up working on accretion disk, you probably don't care about the factor of 3. Well, we see. I tried to resolve this. Somehow this doesn't feel right to me, but I should have noticed that factor of 3. For some reason, I didn't. Okay. Well, thank you, Mina, and let's go on. Problem number 4. Find the relation between the thickness of an accretion disk and its local temperature. Volunteers. Anybody? Okay, so I'm gonna have to volunteer you guys. AJ, have you looked at this? No. AJ, sorry. Hangba. No. Okay, you're just observing. Horace, have you? You haven't figured it out. No, not completely. A little bit, you think? Did you start thinking about it? No. Okay, so let's see who, somebody who we could help along, maybe.
I can do it.
Okay.
We've got a couple ways of doing it. The other brainstorming that might work better.
Okay, perfect.
Thank you.
As long as they're consistent with each other.
Well, I haven't tried the other one. Just the first one I did was just dimensional analysis, seeing what that got. The other way is more realistic, but.
This is on?
Yeah. Looking for the book?
So you recommend we try dimensional analysis. So here's what I came up with. As always, start out just by listing variables that
may matter. So let's start with thickness of the disk, which we'll call L, and that has units of length. Temperature, which we'll just skip a step again, converting to energy. KT. Then we need a typical time scale, which I chose to use the orbital period, call it P, not to get mixed up with the T for temperature. And finally, the mass, which we'll do the could be the mass at the center. Most likely a mass at the central body. Anyways, putting things together, we get dimensionless quantity being KT. And then we just play around. We get L should be roughly proportional to the square root of KT period squared over mass.
Okay. So could you substitute for a period? In terms of, so let's keep that mass to be something different. Well, let's call that MSR or M tilde or something like that. And then substitute for period in terms of Keplerian period, basically. What is it for the formula for period?
Can't recall that off the top.
The circular velocity is that the formula we had was the square root of g over r, right? Now let's that mass to be different from this other mass because there might be more than one mass in the problem. So let's call it something different, but that's okay. So that's the velocity. So what is the period now?
Okay, so period is 2 pi r mm-hmm. over velocity, okay. Or since we don't have scaling factors there, just r over that, which would be, so.
Good. So let's substitute that in there and see what we get.
Okay, so then that.
Okay, good. So perfect. So that's KT over N cubed. Sorry, MS star, and that's multiplied by R cubed. So GOM over R cubed is really Keplerian. Well, I guess it's just 3R. It's just Keplerian. 3D squared is the inverse of frequency squared. But. So let's see, what do we know? So does this have the right dimension? Okay, so let's write L over R becomes dimensionless. So L over R.
Okay, so.
That's the relative thickness of the disk. And by the way, this is not proportional. This is equal, right? Or approximately equal sign. Yeah. So the proportional doesn't necessarily keep the dimension right, but that's okay, so this is interesting. So here's the thing that's dimensional analysis, I guess, as we discussed last time, it can be very helpful, but then you may not know from the beginning what are the right things that enter the problem.
Yeah.
And that might confuse you. That's why I ask you to keep those masses different. And here's the thing. I think this is almost the correct answer if you don't make that MS squared. There are really two different masses.
Yeah.
So, if you just put MMS star, and we can discuss what is the right, what is the other mass that we should put in. Of course, the M that you put in is the right thing. That just comes from the Keplerian frequency. MS star, we're going to figure out what is the right mass that goes in there. But, so what is the other way that you have?
Okay, other way. Let's start over here. Okay, imagine we're looking at a disk edge on. So, looks like this. Now we've got a general distribution of masses along it. Now, from the temperature, we can figure out a typical velocity for these, you know, relative to the standard Keplerian orbit. So, you know, it's roughly proportional, so let's call VZ in a bit would be roughly KT over M.
And what is M?
M would be the mass of the particle. Yeah, so whatever particle we have here. Now, if we imagine that could be the typical velocity we'd find when it's at the center of the ring in the Z dimension and going outward. So it would be oriented randomly. So we'd have basically a random chance of it going in any direction. And I think when we do this formula in three dimensions, we get a factor of 3/2 for the typical velocity, and then we maybe have a 1/2 out in front if we just do it in Z, but anyways, it's the proportionality remains the same. So what I'm thinking of is if we take something in potential like this, which we rotate the frame so All right. Well, we go into a rotating frame of reference around the star U's. I think it's a Lagrangian potential or something, whatever it's called. We can see that above and below the disk, it goes to a higher potential and we'd be pulled back. So if it starts out with a velocity up, we could model its motion. It'll be, you know, somewhat like sinusoidal around the center. And then we calculate the distance away. That'll give us an estimate of the thickness of the disk.
Perfect. So what is that?
Okay. So let's figure.
I think people say that Milky Way does something like that in the plane of the sun does something like that in the plane of the Milky Way. It just goes off and on.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see. Okay. Let's say we've got a particle at radius r, and okay, big mass we'll call m star, and mass of the particle we'll call little m. Just to keep things. The mass of the disk.
Well, let's ignore the mass of the disk.
Yeah. Okay. So let's just pretend we've got a spherically symmetric potential. And okay, we start with a particle in a Keplerian circular orbit around big mass m. So we've got it's out at a distance r. Well, let's say r equals r, and then in z we'll just call it z, and velocity in, well, along, well, yeah, let's just add. Okay. Net radial velocity in theta direction. And then
That's not the amplitude, right? The velocity changes sign.
Yeah, well, let's say we're starting out at z of 0, and just we're choosing it's going upwards. It doesn't really matter in the end. Okay. So let's see. The total attraction from an Keplerian potential at a position of Rz would be
the square root of R squared.
Yeah, R.
That's the potential if you want to.
Yeah, that's force factor. Is. Actually, yeah, let's just go with the potential. Okay. So if we're only perturbing in the z direction, we assume r remains constant. Potential now. Okay. We're assuming r remains constant, perturbing in the z direction.
Let's assume z as a small.
Yeah. So that's small. Yeah. Okay. We can Taylor expand this.
-1/2.
Yeah. Okay. minus 1/2. So is roughly GMR times 1 minus 1/2 Z squared over R squared plus. Like that, right?
I think it's GM over R, the P factor is.
Yeah, over R. Right, right, right.
Okay. So does everybody, I mean, this is just a Taylor response, but I guess everybody's So I mean, I think that's all there is to it. So now you have a harmonic oscillator in the Z direction.
Yeah, so the potential, okay, we've got constant term, so we can just subtract out the constant term there. The goes like
And I think that probably is another minus sign. So I think the beginning from the beginning there's an extra minus
sign. Oh yeah, yeah. Potential is always negative. Okay. So then phi and squared potential, which gives harmonic oscillation and
we gotta find the maximum z value.
Yeah. So let me just think. Okay. Well, energy. Okay. So if we convert this to the energy the particle would have at that, do an M here, and okay, energy from that is 1/2.
It's just KT.
Yeah. It's, yeah. So energy. Now we solve for Z, so. Over GMM, so take out squared. And which miraculously is the same as what we got before.
Yeah, perfect. One of the few times that mental analysis actually works. It's, yeah, but that's great. So now we know what MS star should have been, right?
Yeah. Yeah, so that other mass should have been the particle mass and, yeah, big.
But this is great. So that's perfect, and that's really the derivation. So as long as Z is small, you have low temperature.
Yeah, and of course, along the way, I dropped out a lot of prefactors. But if we were serious about this, we could carry them along.
Absolutely. So that's it. Thank you very much. And so what this teaches us is that the hotter the disk is, the thicker it will get, and if you lose energy through radiation, for example, then your disk becomes thin. That's the whole reason that you have disks, because you lose energy through radiation, and temperature becomes small, and you get a thin disk. That's really, yes, that's exactly why you have so many disks in astrophysics in the universe, because of that relationship. Perfect. So, last problem of this set, and hopefully we're going to finish it in time and get over with this long problem set. So we want to write an approximate formula for turbulent viscosity. Doesn't matter what kind of viscosity is, so. Volunteers. So we've had Nathan today, and we had Brian and Mina, and I think Ajay and Chris and Hangwa. They are we cannot count on them. Can we? Are you going to play a song or no? Okay. Dennis, it's up to Fabric.
Horribly strange solution to this problem.
Okay. That's the good kind. The kind that can get us excited. Well, you can use the book. You're not going to need it for this problem. First, bring it down, and then orient the book. Oops. I think you should put it the other way.
We saw that for a steady disk, steady state compression disk, the rate of energy transfer due to compression is mu r squared okay. This is the rate of change of the angular velocity to radius squared, and this is the viscosity. If you put this there, and you use Kepler's law, you reach Nathan's solution. Okay? So,
so this is basically the definition of viscosity, if you recall. So mu is the eta of that. So why do you call this mu?
Oh, because I've read another book.
It's because that?
Kuduri.
Kuduri.
I've got used to this.
That's fine. I'm just curious where that came from. But so the definition of viscosity was basically eta or mu times derivative of velocity, that's force per unit area. And if you have a force per unit area, you can convert it to, if you multiply that by velocity, then you would get a power. Well, force times velocity gives you work per unit time. And that's supposed to be where it comes from, that formula comes from, although it's a bit more subtle than that. So there is also the state that the observation that if omega is constant across the disk, then there is no viscosity because nothing is rubbing against it. But yeah, this is should be, it's not that hard to derive that relationship. Just from the fact that, from the definition of viscosity. Okay, so go ahead.
So if you write it in terms of V, So here comes the strange part. We now this goes to evidence. We saw that in turbulence, we also have an energy transfer. Which depends on the velocity cubed and escape. And this velocity, we wrote this velocity as u, which is a typical velocity. And L, the typical length. So what I'm going to do here is just to write this as mu.
How was that? Well, okay, so let's see what you get. Okay, so what is mu now?
So I should write that.
Sure, go ahead, please. Well, this is an approximate calculation, really, order of magnitude. So, I mean, that exact form might not be valid, but it has probably the right dimensions. So let's see if it gets the right answer. So do these have the right dimensions, though? So that's both of these are energy dissipation per unit volume or
per unit mass. The problem is that this is per unit volume.
Okay, so then we should have a density somewhere, I guess, to convert. Okay, so we want to divide that by density.
Right.
Just mu divided by density. You say it's wherever you have mu.
Okay.
No, but you say as no, you should then that should multiply that by.
Oh, okay. This is the per unit volume.
Okay. So if you divide both sides by density, it becomes per unit mass, right?
Okay.
Okay. So if you
I should divide it by density.
Yes. Yes. And the left-hand side is then per unit mass. Okay, so
my problem is that you have two dE by dt that have different definitions here. And you should probably, if you just get rid of the rho on the left-hand side, then they have the same definition. So I'm confusing you. But okay, so let's go on with this. Your alpha is dimensional, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay, so have that in mind.
Okay. So
that's fine, mu.
Oh, it's strange. Minus sign.
It doesn't matter that sort of magnitude.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is not really exact math.
And
okay, is that it?
Yeah.
Okay, let's see what we have.
Is the magnitude of this?
It's the scale of the eddies.
I did something similar, but I got a completely different answer.
What is your answer?
I got viscosity is roughly proportional to velocity times density over thickness of disk.
Velocity times density over the thickness of disk.
Yeah.
But what is the thickness of disk? We are speaking of turbulence.
Yeah, thickness of the accretion disk.
But you have L and lambda, which are both length scales. But I think actually both of your results don't have the right conditions.
So it's strange because both of these equations are dimensionally correct, aren't they?
Okay, so let's
because if they are dimensionally correct,
okay, let's make sure that that's the case. Velocity times length. That's
the number. I made a simple algebraic mistake in the last step. Yeah, it should be length on top.
Okay, so it's velocity times length times
length.
It's like a
torque.
Yeah. Viscosity times. Yes, so that's that. Okay, so let's see why this gives you something different. So you have energy dissipation rate, which is that formula looks correct to me actually. So it's the derivative of velocity squared times viscosity. That energy dissipation rate per unit volume or unit mass, depending on if you have the density there. And the left hand side, that's also V lambda cubed divided by lambda. That also sounds reasonable. Okay, so now if you equate the two, wasn't there a square somewhere?
Oh yeah, there is a horrible, yeah.
Okay, now let's see where that takes
us.
So lambda minus 4/3.
Square.
Are you sure that? So you have alpha. Which is u times l to the minus 1/3.
Let me write it again.
Yes.
Alpha. Mm-hmm. U l s.
Four thirds. Good, perfect. So I guess we are in agreement. So it is interesting though. I mean, I think this analysis tells us is that there is no single viscosity that you can really associate to a turbulence flow because turbulence is not really a viscous process. Viscosity it's very specific. So it comes from local collisions of atoms with each other. Turbulence is a long happens on all scales and is due to large eddies, not point-like particles. So it's not really viscous process. That's why you don't get a number out of this analysis. But at every scale, you can define as an effective viscosity by something like this, which is very reasonable. The energy dissipation rate you expect from viscosity, if you assume it to be the same as the energy dissipation rate you get from turbulence. But the number you get is different on different scales. And you can, for example, you can imagine what it is on the largest scale you have in the problem, where lambda is the order L. And there you get rho times U times L. But then I guess what this relationship teaches us, which is interesting, is that your viscosity becomes smaller and smaller on a smaller scale, which is reasonable because your eddies become smaller. And so if they become smaller, the idea I had was, maybe another way to do it is from problem one. If you remember from problem one, we recapped the Reynolds number and viscosity. There was for a simple molecular collision. So I just wanted to write that just for the right hand formula. We had a formula that looked like this: rho times u r times l times lambda, right? And this is just a mean free path of molecules. This is the velocity of molecules. And this is this. And this is basically more or less the same thing. If you assume there is one length of scale in the problem. And if the smaller your mean free path, then the smaller is the viscosity. So you would imagine if there's an effective viscosity for a turbulent flow, it's going to be a smaller and smaller scales because eddies become smaller. So and they travel in a lot smaller distance. But it's not an exact correspondence, as you can imagine. But lambda is a number for molecules. It doesn't depend on the scale. These are the same lambdas, by the way, so don't confuse it. So the one is wavelength, the one in Faber's family. The one up there is mean free path. But on the largest scales, for example, if you are interested in dynamics on larger scales, you can say set lambda to be equal to L. That's a maximum value that viscosity gets. And then these two formulas are dimensionally the same. So this is a famous formula people have been using for lots of years. And this is it's called alpha viscosity. If I just set L equal to lambda and put the dimensionless constant, everything in some alpha. What people have been doing was to assume that mu is alpha, let's call it Schapiro's, it's S, it stands for Schapiro's, times rho, times u, times the thickness of the disk. And sorry, by u, people use a speed of sound. Now, if this is also a speed of sound of the disk, we can discuss about that. That if you assume there is some sort of equipartition between different turbulent velocity and thermal velocity, then this becomes the speed of sound. This part, I guess, it's not clear it would be the case. But how I replace u by speed of sound? Principle: you could have u could be the turbulent velocity could be much smaller than the speed of sound. But it cannot be much larger than the speed of sound because, and that's something you're going to learn next week, hopefully, that if velocities become larger than the speed of sound, then you create shock waves, you heat up the system until these two become more or less the same. But velocity can be much less than the speed of sound. For example, if you have, like, in a river, the speed of sound is much larger than the turbulent velocity. So there is another factor that can absorb energies. Dimensionless constant, but then this is the formula that people have been using, and are still using to this day. I've been using it for 30 years. This is a dimensionless parameter called Schapiro's and your alpha that people use to, and this is something around 0.01%. And And the reason actually for this is that the turbulent velocity is usually not less than the thermal velocity. So turbulent velocity is usually less than 10% of the thermal velocity. That's why this is so small. For this formula, this is actually the prefactor of order 1, as you would expect from the dimensional analysis. But this is indeed the effective viscosity that people use in turbulent situations. And it's so what does the definition? And it's an approximation. Because molecular viscosity, if you calculate it, is much smaller. And so it's not really that important compared to this kind of viscosity, the effective turbulence viscosity. I guess something that people also call this anomalous viscosity, because it's not really viscosity, it has this scale dependence. But it can be much larger, so it's much more important in difficult situations, usually. Thank you very much, Robert. Perfect. So, as crazy as the methods may sound, it often gives you the right answer. So I guess if the person who uses it is smart enough, which is good. We are all very smart. Perfect. Thank you very much. And I guess we meet in the afternoon. I think Mark is going to give you problem set number 6. Sorry, number 5. And he's going to introduce everything. So, are you guys going to hand in your problem set number 4? Thank you.
Direct my solution.
Okay, sure, absolutely. You can give it to me later. Okay, thank you.